Probably not from Kung Fu Panda. In honor of The Foreigner, what's your favorite Jackie Chan moment?
I'm Katie Rich, and I'm going with the moment in The Karate Kid where he teaches Jaden Smith to fight by putting his jacket on, jacket off, jacket on, jacket off.
Did you say jacket off?
I sure did. So did Jackie Chan.
All right. I'm Matt Patches. I'm going to go with the big drunken fight scene from, I actually think it's from Drunken Master 2, which was released as The Legend of Drunken Master, which is basically the reboot, but where he gets really drunk for the first time and fights people. It's amazing.
You're not in the show notes, are you, Patches?
Oh, I'm not. Is that what you picked?
I'm going to pick The Legend of the Drunk Master scene where he's in the town square and breaking bottles to stay drunk.
All right, all right.
What's the point of writing things down if Patches isn't going to get in the notes?
Look, I was scrambling. I was
all this right off the...
Dave,
I'm a drunken master.
I can make this right. I am David Ehrlich, and I am going to pick the scene from The Legend of Drunken Master where they fight under the train right after the scene in the town square with the bows and stuff. It's great.
All good. Legend of Drunken Master.
I did this last week too. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry.
You did.
I'm going to go with the tuxedo where Jackie Chan explains why water is running out and Jennifer Love Hewitt helps him find the water.
Fair enough.
Because he's drunk.
You've seen a tuxedo?
Oh, yeah.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good. Then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room. It's episode 185, and it's Tuesday, October 10th. And on this date in 1956, the movie Giant with James Dean and Elizabeth Taylor, what a combo, it premiered in New York City. And based on how movie release dates worked back then, I have no idea if that's when it actually is its anniversary. But let's do it. It's 61 years old.
Classier than any movie we'll talk about this on this episode, probably.
Yeah, they didn't have like high high level releases where everybody would see it. You'd have to roll the print down to a lesser place.
You mean they didn't debut trailers on Monday Night Football and let people talk about them on Skype?
No, they hadn't yet.
Ah, spoilers for
that
the rest
was a
of this
brave
episode.
New world.
But before we get into any trailers that may or may not be new as we record this, we've got some giveaways to handle
and some reviews to read based on the giveaways we're giving away. Congratulations to two iTunes users, Nicole_719 and Hyde Man. You have won copies of A Ghost Story on Blu-ray. So you got to get in touch with us via the tweets, via the Facebook, one way or another. Maybe leave a message on our fightinginthewarroom.com. Get in
Show
touch
up
so we
to
can get
Matt
your address.
Show up to Matt Patch's apartment in Park Slope and demand a Blu-ray.
I don't have the physical copies on me. Anyway, you guys left iTunes reviews and comply with our demands, and now David's going to read those reviews. We got a bunch. We'll probably read some over the next few weeks. But
and thank you to everybody who left them.
Yeah, that was awesome. And people shared some good stories, which was really fun. But now we're going to read the winning entries. And they were randomly selected. Everyone who left a review, I kind of put some random numbers in and picked you out of a hat. So these aren't the best reviews necessarily, but they're very good reviews, so it's worth reading them.
No, I'm going to start with the best review as a little added bonus. It's very short, from Kid Scheinberg, who says, I considered writing a review to enumerate the ways in which David Ehrlich has let me down recently, but then I thought about how volatile the world is at the moment, so I thought better of it. And that
wow.
was
next
helpful.
Time, Kid Scheinberg.
It inspired me to reflect.
That guy's going to get invited to Ehrlich family holidays.
Show up to David's
tradition,
house.
Right?
Indeed. All right, now on to our winners. Nicole719 says, a beautiful gem in an otherwise frightening world. Fighting in the War Room is truly wonderful. The show's four hosts couldn't be more intelligent and engaging. There's always a genuine warmth and sincerity that cuts through the snark, causing each weekly podcast download to feel more like checking in with four of your funniest friends. Their love for each other can be truly moving, almost as moving as one of my favorite films from this year, Columbus. I saw it over 2 months ago, but still can't seem to get it out of my head. If this is enough to win me a copy of another one of my favorites from this year, A Ghost Story, That's great. If not, it's enough of a prize to listen to David Ehrlich's velvet voice reading this. Oh, David, your intelligence and sublime taste in film only makes you more attractive. But let's be honest, you didn't really need that wow. Okay. Let's be honest, you didn't really need the help. What a lucky woman your wife is. Anyway, great show.
So,
guys,
when I said that we randomly selected them, I should have meant that you could lose the option of winning the Blu-ray.
Was this review helpful? I would say enormously. Is that an option? It says a lot about my broken psyche that I read any compliment given by strangers as a sarcastic insult. who was our other winner here?
Hyde Man,
indeed. Let's see if he talks about my stunning good looks. Don't get ahead of me. I haven't read it yet. This podcast is moving and profound, exclaim critics across the nation. When I heard the Fighting in the War Room crew was giving away a Blu-ray, I mean, when I finally convinced my mom to give me her iTunes store password, as I'm one of those Google Play people, well, I just about rushed to my computer after finishing their latest episode, of course. People need to get on this. Honestly, it's the only movie podcast I listen to, but it baffles the mind that more people I don't yet. In parentheses, I live in Los Angeles, so yes, it would be helpful for them, commute and industry-wise. Thank you all for the memories and laughs during many visits to the gym and many car rides to Santa Monica. There have been times when a new episode pops up and I actually decide to go on a run just to listen to it. I mean, if that's not speaking to the specialness on display here, I don't know what could. Dave, you put this thing together so well. I always forget the four of you aren't in the same room. I just assumed everyone loved interrupting. Music is on point. Whatever this SpongeBob thing has been lately, I thank you. And my girlfriend, overhearing it, does not. Katie, you're a consummate pro, really classing up the joint. Patches, your diverse taste in film is an intriguing and welcome one in this divisive world of ours. David, you're the man, even when you're brutal. My girlfriend and I bonded over moments reading some of your classic reviews together. Mother's Day is one for the ages. Together, an irresistible group. The chemistry makes it all tick. It's fun to hear friends talk about movies, especially when I don't have to actually disagree with my real friends in reality. To my car ride jogging gym buddy movie brethren, I raise a toast. Please keep making more of these. I even forgive you for never really talking about The Leftovers this year. Yeah. It's okay. Oh yes, I almost forgot. What a generous group these guys are, doing fun giveaways and contests all the time. Coming from this man who didn't have a movie pass in time to see A Ghost Story, why yes, the Blu-ray sounds delightful. Almost as delightful as rewatching the incredibly moving Olive Kitteridge last week with my girlfriend. Letterboxd says it's a movie, so I'm going with it. If anyone can make it through the back half of that film series masterpiece without openly weeping, maybe they just need to go to Maine and have it out with their mother already. And that doesn't count as a movie in everyone's mind. Check out Stronger. This now MoviePass-equipped man wept alone in the theater at a weekday matinee. Seriously, though, especially in light of recent events, it is one of the best truth-based movies I've ever seen about the sometimes terrifying day and age in America. The end. Thank you, Hyde Man. This review was very helpful because I needed that extra little push to go see Stronger. So thank you.
Whew. Makes me realize that maybe I should have seen Stronger before, you know, current events made it even more difficult, but that's a good review.
But isn't it? It's now going to help you deal. It's going to help you respond.
Maybe.
Although I hear it's not really. It's about like people taking advantage of those hard moments in life. So it might make you more cynical. Who knows?
Well, thank you to everybody who entered. This is really fun. These reviews are really above and beyond. And I hear we're gonna have more contests to inspire people.
Surprise, we're doing another Blu-ray giveaway. Funny enough, I have two copies of a movie that I think is very, very funny. Girls Trip. I think, did we talk about Girls Trip on the podcast? I think we did.
Yeah, we definitely did.
Yes,
this is just one of the freaking funniest movies I saw all summer. And you can win a copy. And instead of doing iTunes, this movie is about getting together with your best girlfriends and having a fun time. And that's what I want you to do on Facebook. So we're going to post this episode after it goes live on Facebook. What you have to do to win, at your friend, put them in a message, send us a sweet note. Tell them about why you love the podcast, but you have to add them in the message so that they see it and so that other people can pile on. And when you put an entry in, you'll throw your number into the hat. So all you have to do, again, go on facebook.com/writingthewarm and leave us a note and tell us why you love the podcast or a favorite episode, but you got to at your friend, bring him along with you. So yeah, that's it. Girls Trip. Win it on a Blu-ray. Thanks for the iTunes reviews. Now an episode. Up speaking. It's the dream.
Dave, I heard there were a bunch of dudes who tried to go to McDonald's for some shit over the weekend and got mad about it. And this is the dumbest thing that I've ever heard in my life.
That's every weekend. What are you talking about?
Oh, God.
Yeah, that's like
everyone's
every time dudes go to McDonald's,
specifically,
they're getting angry about
they
it.
They went to McDonald's this weekend for a reason.
All right. So I have mostly heard about Rick and Morty through you, Dave, because I know that you are a fan. And then recently I've seen numerous people tweet that Rick and Morty fans are worse than any other fans on the internet and haven't really paid that much attention. And then over the weekend, a bunch of them got mad at a McDonald's and I feel like I finally got it, even though I don't really get it. What the hell happened?
Well, so this season of Rick and Morty, season 3, ended up being the most popular or most watched comedy amongst the millennial demographic, beating out your Saturday Night Lives, your Big Bang Theories. And unbeknownst to that, they made a joke at the beginning of season 3 that Rick's series-long arc was that he wanted the Szechuan sauce released by McDonald's in promotion of the film Mulan in the 90s. And what became a throwaway joke about weird, specific giveaway things that you would maybe probe your own memory to try again became a reality after this, you know, super popular season happened and people started obsessing about it. McDonald's sent some to the show creators to sort of show that they were in on the joke, and they decided that they were going to release a super limited quantity to promote their new buttermilk chicken fingers or whatever the fuck. So at 2 p.m. last Saturday, at certain locations you had to go check online, you could get a chance at getting a packet of Szechuan sauce. What they didn't know is how big the turnout would be, and so they ended up sending somewhere between 20 packets to 100 packets per location, where thousands of people showed up, many of which, not realizing how promotions work, proceeded to make asses of themselves by hassling employees, jumping the counter, blocking traffic, doing your general pissed off fan things. Or as I saw somebody tweet today, sauce riots, huh? You don't even want to know what I did for Beanie Babies back in 95. But everybody was sort of pissed that McDonald's screwed up this rollout of this sauce and completely underestimated the Rick and Morty fandom size and how willing they were to drive sometimes across state lines to get a chance of Szechuan sauce. So they are going to bring it back. It sounds like almost completely. But McDonald's has caved, right, as of the recording of this podcast. We don't know the date, but we will actually bring back Szechuan
sauce. The alt Rick has triumphed.
Exactly. Another one of my favorite tweets from today was, can next season, can Rick be obsessed with universal healthcare?
Yes, that was a very good tweet.
So, I think it's especially interesting after our conversation about, you know, purging your own fandoms of disgusting elements. The Rick and Morty fandom is going to have to deal with some of the more unsightly elements that have sprung out within it. I'm not just talking about sauce riots, even though that's ridiculous, but I am talking about things like doxing the female writers, which is what led to this whole idea that the Rick and Morty fan community
was
toxic.
When did that happen?
So I don't want to give too much weight to these conspiracy theories, but how it was strung together is way back on the Harmontown podcast, At one point, Dan Harmon, possibly drunk, completely blurts out, "I know, I should be editing episode 304. It's going to be the worst episode ever, and it's going to be my fault." That episode ended up being The Vindicators, which a lot of people think is the worst episode of the season, and it's an episode with two female credited writers. So once that episode aired, the conclusion was, of course, the writers are ruining the show.
Wow.
If you listen to Storm of Spoilers, we thought that was one of the better episodes of the season, but it led to some sad fan reactions that then caused Dan Harmon to come out and sort of say that there is a sect of Rick and Morty fandom that he thinks are like whiny babies. And so that started a whole bunch of infighting. And this sauce, this bad promotional campaign just managed to inflame what were embers going out because the season is over. Managed to just catch the end of that obsession and blow it out of proportion.
So this is like when the kneeling at football games was almost over and then Trump tweeted about it and it started all over again?
Exactly. Oh, like we were just about to say.
I gotta say that's not the best analogy.
I thought it was perfect.
Totally flawless enough. Yes. I don't think I need to belabor that point and point out why that's not the best analogy.
No,
but,
moving on.
Moving on. I think Katie was saying it somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but
yes.
Dave, as our resident Rick and Morty fanboy, can you describe to us your embarrassment over this? Is it like I am fortunate enough for the things that I love to not buy? I mean, there are, you know, a Bjork fan fucking killed himself on, well, it was before YouTube, but like there are, and he was after sending her death threats or whatever. I mean, like there are things, there's toxic people and people, I'm not being articulate, people glom onto anything regardless of what it was, and it usually doesn't reflect on the subject or on the other fandom, but I think that within the nerd sphere, there is a certain degree of intensity that you don't see with like Mad Men fans, for example. And that is not a qualitative judgment. It is just sort of the culture around it. But can you speak to how this all makes you feel as a sane individual who happens to love Rick and Morty?
Sure. I mean, it's sad that, I mean, the association that you're making and that everybody else is making this week is, boy, Rick and Morty fans suck. And you can't say no, because even if you're a fan of this podcast and you're our, you know, only listener, I'm not saying that you're allowed to jump up on a McDonald's counter and yell at the employees there. Like, that's unacceptable human behavior. But like, everybody who does unacceptable human behavior is going to have like reasons they think it's worthwhile that I'm not going to agree with. So I'm super psyched that Rick and Morty isn't airing. It got really good ratings. The show is going to move on and the fandom gets to do what it does best in the off season, which is trickle away until only the pure fans are left being very quiet and making Reddit shit posts. And I never thought I'd want to get back to there, but let's get back there as soon as
possible. But what's so curious about it is, I mean, I'm a really big Rick and Morty fan too. I don't think I would ever go to a McDonald's for Szechuan sauce. So that part is baffling, and hearing kind of the hearsay of these moments is surprising to me. I didn't realize the fandom was so toxic, and I wouldn't necessarily include myself in the fandom. You know, I just watched the show, and I think,
especially not now.
No, definitely not now. Well, I mean, to include yourself in the fandom, I think is weird right off the bat. Like, what? I guess the fandom is the intensity of reading about theories or processing. I don't even know what fandom requires at this point. It's just the obsession level of investment. You know, this weekend was the New York Comic Con here in the city, and you know, I can't really go to Comic Cons anymore. It's just too intense. The ferocity of like storming merch tables and trying to get autographs and just the fervor over these shows. I don't have the genes required to obsess over stuff. I can only enjoy things, and I have to stand back, and I'm always not admiring, but just like jaw dropped when people are just obsessed with things. I'm not capable of it. But the thing about Rick and Morty is that the whole season, the season three, has really been about like Rick being a despicable human being, this character who has no obligation to help his family and no respect for anybody else because he conceives himself as this kind of godlike figure, but also being chipped away at by emotion and family and these obligations that he may be starting to realize exist. You know, he can travel through warp dimensions and go on adventures, and he'll always win. The Vindicator episode that Dave was mentioning earlier is a bit, it's this kind of like riff on Saw and Guardians of the Galaxy all at once, and about how Rick is the true worst enemy of every single person in this universe, and he is the smartest man, and the only way to kill him is to, like, for him to kill himself. I thought it was a really fascinating episode that pit Rick against himself. But what are these fans processing, Dave? Why can't they take away the lessons of the show and realize that they are Ricks who need to look inward and not be fans of themselves or egotistical maniacs who are obsessed with things? You can't be obsessed with things and watch Rick and Morty and walk away still obsessed with things. It's crazy.
Well, that's why I tried to frame it in the how the sauce appeared on the show was as a placeholder for how ridiculous this all is. And that joke was obviously lost on a mass full of people that I don't know are just too young to know what it's like to actually stand in line for something you don't get. Like, this used to be a part of fandom. So I keep thinking that this is just, it's more like, because it's so popular, it's like we turned on the light and there were more cockroaches than we thought in the room with us.
When was the last time you stood on a line for something you didn't get? I mean, what are you doing as an adult man standing on a line for something that you're not going to get? Like, I'll stand on the line waiting for my driver's license or something because it is guaranteed to me because I'm at the DMV. But, like, you know, I don't know.
Okay, man, that's how I feel about all of Comic-Cons.
Or film festivals. There's plenty of times in film festivals you stand in line without a guarantee that you're going to get in. David.
The coda to this conversation should be, I think you should watch Rick and Morty. I think it's a really good show.
Makes you want to watch Rick and Morty. That's why
I think I hear a lot of people saying that and resisting it. And there's a total backlash against Rick and Morty that it's some sort of like weird bro show. And the love for it is misguided and rooted in whatever example we saw in the Szechuan sauce gate. But it has nothing to do with that. That's what it's so baffling, that it's totally an argument against this behavior and is really pushing the envelope in the third season about taking cartoon violence and crazy parody and matching it with this behavior check, this standing back from your own reality and questioning everything, and eventually the real adventure is you.
It's a good show,
but even Avatar had people that are like, I want to live on Pandora, so I'm going to kill myself. Like, we can't that fandoms are going to only be people that represent what the art represents.
I'm just never going to be able to forget how this show and its fans, mostly its fans, of course, somehow made it so that Mike Pence flying to Indiana just to walk out during the national anthem of a fucking football game wasn't the single dumbest thing that happened in our culture this weekend.
There you go. You had to go there.
We started
there's the David, the Ehrlich take.
Hot take.
We need a sound effect for Ehrlich take.
Hot Szechuan
Ehrlich take.
When I found you, I saw raw, untamed power. And beyond that, something truly special.
Speaking of toxic fandoms, the Last Jedi trailer has premiered online.
Why not start there? The Last Jedi trailer has premiered online. We were literally pausing starting this podcast to start it. Right now, Joanna Robinson and Neil Miller are sending screenshots into my chat, asking questions. It's happening. It's the second trailer. We're a couple months out. Guys, what are your initial reactions? I want to start with David Earl.
Oh, it's not the Last Jedi trailer, to be correct. I mean, I want to put it out there, right? We're getting more. This is the second. But not the last, right?
No,
not the last Jedi trailer.
There's the second total last Jedi. Advertising blackout between now and December 15th.
There'll be new cuts, but I'm not expecting any substantially new footage until TV spots. So I would say trailer-wise, okay.
This is the end of the promotional blitz.
This is it. See the movie.
Well, I am on record and will reaffirm my belief, trailer be damned, that this is going to be the the Empire. I mean, it's they're so following, it seems, to a T, the ebb and flow of the original series, the original trilogy, that I have every reason to think that this is going to be the Empire Strikes Back of this trilogy, not only where it falls and the story beats that it serves, but also in its emotional palette, in the place where it leaves us, in its fandom, in its ultimate appreciation, the appreciation that we have for it. I do think it's probably going to wind up being the best of these three films. That being said, as someone who's sort of Star Wars agnostic, this trailer did a lot. The first trailer did next to nothing for me, and this one did even less. I think this is probably a really hard movie to cut a trailer for, because almost every scene is going to be spoilery in a way, unlike the
rooted in story. I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think that cutting a trailer for The Force Awakens would have been a dream job, because everything that you were able to show would be sort of in a vacuum and exciting, and people's eyes
an introduction.
Yeah, and I think this is probably a much harder task. You got the porgs to satisfy a certain quadrant of the fan base. I don't know. It's fine. I'm going to see it. It doesn't
Are you
really.
Telling me the Pusheen fan I'll in say, you doesn't like the porgs?
He does. But I'll say, I have to say two quick things, two little nitpicks. Mark, every single line that Mark Hamill says in this trailer sounds wrong. They all sound really just flat and Mark Hamill at his worst. And I joked on Twitter, and this went over just great. That it asked if it was too late to recast.
You knew what you were doing.
And apparently it might be. I'm a little bit worried about his performance. I think it was definitely a virtue in the first one that he did not have any lines. And my other concern is, that's not really a concern, but it does look like the movie is going to be a lot of people standing in the blackness of space, yelling at one another about their destinies. And that's not really what I'm all about. Anyway.
I gotta stick up for Mark Hamill here for a second. I think that he is playing unhinged here, and that will work for him. I don't think he's a great actor, but the like voice acting and stuff that we've seen him play, and like the weirdo characters he's played on screen, he can kind of like go off the deep end. I think that's where Luke is at this moment. He's terrified of people with power because it's gone wrong for him before, and now he's playing like, "Whoa, you got the Force," and he's just gonna be blown back. He's gonna be a crazy old wizard. You know, this is good for him. It'll work.
I think I'm in it mostly for Adam Driver, which I didn't think before I watched this trailer, but I was excited. I like his like weird black scar on his face. The way that they've cut this interaction apparently between him and Carrie Fisher, I doubt is what's actually happening in the movie. But I like the idea of him squaring off against her. I know we don't really know what to expect from her in this movie because Carrie Fisher died shortly after she finished filming. But I think that Adam Driver's story as Kylo Ren and what's going to happen to him, especially it ends on that button of him like extending his hand to Rey. I don't know. I'm revealing to myself that I'm intrigued by him the most.
And Dave,
I like it all.
I love Leia's collar on her costume.
Yeah,
it's very
me
tall.
Too.
I want to hide behind it.
I'm real bummed that she's not going to be in any more Star Wars movies. It's like not what's important about Carrie Fisher dying too early, but seeing this made me think that.
This trailer has enough pieces in it to take what I thought I knew about The Last Jedi and connect them into my mind where I think I have the three-act structure now.
Yeah.
You've seen the movie in your imagination.
That is hilarious because I don't think I know anything.
Well, it's
I mean, I haven't tried
to,
either.
It's one thing to tell myself this is going to end on a darker note, on a little bit of a cliffhanger, that it's probably going to have something to do with Rey's allegiance being in doubt, and it's another to see firsthand how flat that might be and how familiar it might feel. I don't know. It's going to be a 2-hour and 30-minute movie, and I've seen exactly 90 seconds of it, so I don't really feel qualified to judge.
So submit to Rotten Tomatoes now.
Yeah, I'm going to go with...
That's going to go over great, too.
It would be a bummer if I didn't like this, because my only prediction last year that was more off the mark than thinking Hillary Clinton was going to win the presidency was that Rogue One was going to be my favorite Star Wars movie. And for the first 5 minutes of Rogue One, that prediction seemed like it might come true. And then the rest of the movie happened. And I think you can really tell, looking at the internet and the discourse that people have been engaging in over the last 10 months, that movie has died. and in people's estimation.
Yeah, when it
fandom.
Went to Netflix, that was a bad sign. Like, Force yeah. Awakens has not gone to Netflix through the Disney deal, but there's Rogue One. But this has something that Rogue One that you like about Rogue One. It looks very tactile. You know, it has, like, real environments. There's Rey
Does
on
it?
The island, training, that's cool. And you love the opening of Rogue One. That's really on
I
an
do.
Actual that, coast.
Yeah. There's no doubt that they went to that little island and
Ryan Johnson's doing this movie yeah. for you. He's trying for you.
Well, we'll see. We'll see.
Are you trying to say this movie is for the critics and not the fans?
Wow.
It's for everyone except the Dark Universe fans.
No, he's saying this movie
there's
is
none
for
of
exactly
them. Good thing.
One critic.
It's for David Ehrlich.
It's for David.
It's like that Kevin Costner movie, Swing Vote, except for I am
It's down to you.
I've seen that movie, that Kevin Costner.
No one's seen that movie. Come
I
on.
Saw that movie.
This weekend, a long-awaited sequel finally hit theaters. It was not Boo 2, the new Madea movie. It was actually Blade Runner 2049.
Wait, there's a Boo 2?
Yeah, Boo 2 comes out in 2 weeks. In Boo 2 weeks.
Oh, I thought I was unaware that Boo did well enough.
Boo is
I guess
Boo's
it's called classic.
Boo's one of the better Madea movies, I would say. And Boo 2
it changed the way I viewed black Halloween comedy. That's for
wow.
sure.
Wow. Okay. So Boo 2 in theaters in 2 weeks. That's Fighting in the War Room. We'll be back. Next, I'm sorry. So we're talking about Blade Runner 2049. A few people saw it, not enough people. It totally bombed. This is 35 years actually after the first Blade Runner. But this movie takes place 30 years in the timeline of the Blade Runner movies. I feel like there's mixed reviews. You know, this movie screamed for critics and people were going crazy, and then people kind of dialed it down. And I'm not exactly sure how all of you feel about it. How does the audience that actually showed up to see it feel about it? Well, to give you an idea, Blade Runner, the original 1982 film by Ridley Scott, starring Harrison Ford and a bunch of other cats, is the 142nd best movie according to the IMDb Top 250. And Blade Runner 2049 is the 50th greatest movie of all time, according to the IMDb Top 250.
But below Whiplash, as it turns out.
Yeah, it's not as good as Whiplash, and it's not as good as The Untouchables. Anyway, so Blade Runner 2049 picks up 30 years after the events of the original Blade Runner. Deckard, played by Harrison Ford, is nowhere to be found, and he's actually not really important to the story for a while. This story picks up with Ryan Gosling.
Wait, do you want to start spoilers now? Because you may have already gone too far for some people.
Really? Okay.
I don't know. I don't care.
This is completely spoiler-filled conversation.
This movie is in theaters. You can pay to go see it.
I actually think that the twists of this movie really work, and they're fun and exciting, and they add a lot to the story, so we have to go there beginning to end.
I mean, the premise of the movie is being hidden from the marketing, and I think it's smart that they did, because it's a nice thing to discover for yourself, but I think you do kind of have to stay spoilers from the very start.
I feel the opposite way. I think we should have known at least the plot of the first 30 minutes of this movie before walking into this movie.
I do agree. Yeah, I knew nothing, and I guess it was slave filling. But hey, here, Kay is the name of the new replicant played by Ryan Gosling. He is a Blade
played
runner.
By Tommy Lee Jones.
Thank you.
He's back. MIB.
The fact that he's a replicant also is hidden from the marketing.
Yeah, it's true. That's true. You don't know anything. It's just pretty. I think that was the marketing hook.
Yeah, beautiful
really
and
no, it's not. We're gonna get into this, but one of my biggest reservations about this movie was that I thought the look of it was all wrong, and that all fucking jerking over Roger Deakins is misplaced, because no matter how attractive images may be, the value of cinematography is rooted in not just their prettiness, but in how they serve the overall production, and in this case, I thought that they were one of the movie's great
failings. When I use the word pretty, I'm talking on a multi-layer way. I'm talking about it's beautiful cinematographically. I'm talking about that it's informing the shots. I'm going deep here. But the quick setup here is that Kay is exterminate. No, what are they? They were. He's retiring. Another replicant.
Retiring.
He's found Dave Bautista, who is this guy Sapper Morton. He's farming. He's escaped society. He's on the run, I guess. He's hiding out, and he's living on a farm. What is he farming? He's farming like worms.
Maggots, I think.
Yeah.
Protein worms.
Yeah, protein worms. That's crazy. So many little details. And yeah, he has to retire, Mr. Bautista, because no replicant shall walk among the people. And
are we all condemning ourselves to a life with no, you know, with no pensions, no social security? We're all just going to work for so long that retirement will become synonymous with death.
Oh God!
Is that what this movie is setting us up for?
It's prepping you for the not the future, but the present.
Great.
That's already among here for you. But anyway, Ryan Gosling stumbles upon a huge mystery that involves a new replicant or an old replicant who has perhaps given birth. She's definitely given birth to twins, maybe? Eh? Or is it a fake? There's so many twists and turns, but Ryan Gosling's going to figure out this mystery. And did it make any sense to you guys? Did you really enjoy the twists and turns of this? David's clearly not, but Katie, you saw this movie last night. It's fresh on your mind. What did you make of Blade Runner 2049, the sprawling sci-fi?
And I famously have trouble keeping track of twists. Like, I'm not very good at seeing where a story is going or, like, following details. I had no trouble following the twistiness of this. Like, that, the idea that, like, is it twins? Is it fake? Is it not? Like, I was kind of with the way that it set up all of the pieces of the mystery, which I really appreciated. I think what this movie does really well is it's a very long movie. There's a lot of set pieces. There's a lot of characters in it, but it's pretty simple. Like, and I think, David, maybe this was something you were suggesting you had a problem with, that it's, like, it's presenting this gigantic world and then not doing a whole lot in it. But I like that in a mystery story, especially. Like, I, you know, it can be twisty, but it needs to be, like, pretty straightforward of where it's going. And I think what really anchored it was Ryan Gosling. You've got this character in kind of the Blade Runner tradition. You've got someone who's, like, trying to figure out who he is. What I find kind of amazing, to get really spoilery, is that it brings back Harrison Ford's Deckard character and still doesn't answer if he's a replicant, which is bold and kind of enjoyable. But you get Ryan Gosling, and from the very beginning, knows that he's a replicant, and then has reason to start questioning that. And you are kind of with him in this journey of doing that. And you see him interacting with his hologram girlfriend, and she is also a robot, but kind of a different level of robot. And I thought all of that idea of identity finding and knowing whether or not you're real and what you know and what of your memories are real was really effective, because Ryan Gosling was playing it really well. He's really good at being vulnerable, and he doesn't do that a lot, especially the way that he did it here. So it's like this pretty satisfying, like, noirish detective story, but with a actual emotional story at the center of it, which I haven't seen the original Blade Runner in a long time, but I don't remember feeling as attached to the people or the replicants in it as I did in this one. And I thought that, I'm not going to say it's better than the original Blade Runner. I haven't seen the original in a while, but I like that added element of it. Dave, how about you?
I mean, it was a very pretty looking film that did some great things with the Blade Runner world and with the visuals of it, but I really, the plotting of it really fell flat for me. And I think in retrospect, the marketing fell flat. So it, like, twists itself to be like, maybe it's two entirely different movies, you know, that are there that are sort of bucking against each other. There's one that is this plot about a replicant child, a Christ, essentially. As a miracle Christ child that's going to save an entire people that's held in slavery by another entire people. That part's boring as hell. And then there's the other pieces that they use to try to throw you off that scent that is pulled from, you know, Pinocchio, child slavery, Nabokov's Pale Fire poem, visual, like, Deckard's keeping bees in the Las Vegas desert specifically so a bee could land on his arm and he doesn't kill it, like a wasp lands on your arm. What do you do? I kill it in the first movie. So there are all these, like, pieces and callbacks and, like, a cool little Her movie going on in the side. But when you slam them all together, they're not adding anything to the Blade Runner world. It all feels like an empty chase. So when it gets to the last shot, I'm supposed to be thinking, you know, does it make a difference that she has snow inside the bubble and there's snow outside the bubble? And does that mean anything's real? but I'm not thinking that. I'm just thinking there's the answer to the question nobody was answering, because the question is, can you live with something not knowing if it's real? So by the time this movie ended, I felt a lot more like Prisoners than I did like Blade Runner.
Oh, man. I hate Prisoners so much.
It's the worst thing you can say. It's so terrible.
I'm surprised to say that I think Dave and I are more or less on the same page on this one. I actually thought that the plot that they engineered for this film was rather brilliant. I think that, and this sort of speaks to what both Dave and Katie were saying about how, what this movie does well in a way that a lot of other similar movies have tried to do, and have had trouble committing to the premise as well as this movie does, is really muddy the waters between what it means to, what it means to be alive, and essentially like why that matters in regards to the conversation of artificial intelligence and synthetic creations. You know what movie this movie trounced in every way in that regard is Ex Machina. Ex Machina is a movie that I watched and thought the entire time, she's a fucking robot. None of this matters. Why are you in love with the robot?
How have we not had this conversation? This is exactly how I felt in that movie, and I felt so alone.
We have had this conversation, and you're both wrong.
No, we're not wrong. It's like, I patch, just because you could slip a cardigan on a robot and want to have sex with her does not mean that she is a, or it is a sentient creature.
Okay.
Listen, we all know about your robot fetishes. But the,
hey, it's a Roomba, okay?
This has got way too real for me. What this movie, I think, does very well is, and the masterstroke of having Ryan Gosling be a replicant and learning that 100% from the very first scene, is that you sort of lose focus on that. You start to see him as the main character. He has our eyes through the story. And as a result of doing so, you recognize that his reality is as valid as anyone else's reality, even if some of it is partially programmed. And that adds real weight to the question of, is Deckard a replicant or not? Because you recognize the ultimate truth that they were trying to impart in the first one, which is a superior film in almost every other way, which is that it doesn't matter. That life is real to those who believe it's real. And that's it's sort of this all the shared dream that we're all having. And I think that is something the movie does very, very, very well. It's also incredibly boring. There is no dramatic momentum to this film at all. There are so many dead scenes and enormous pockets of dead air. I have a problem.
What do you think is the biggest dead? I mean, be specific. What? Because I wasn't bored for a second in this movie.
There is not a single scene in this movie that I found dramatically engaging.
Wow.
And it's all just mood and atmosphere. And I felt that strongly during the first scene. And I was like, well, this scene isn't really working, but I'm sure it will lead to something that does. And it just never did. And
what about
when he goes to Las Vegas, I think it completely falls apart. I think all the female characters are not strong. My biggest gripe, as I said earlier, is the look. What I love about the original Blade Runner is that dystopian feeling where it's this cluttered, twinkling world where it's always so strange and fanciful, and it really stoked my imagination. And this just feels empty. There are about 11 people left on Earth in this version. They've all gone away to the other colonies, I suppose.
In the movie, you're dissing something that is part of the text, which is everyone's trying to get off world. No one wants to be on Earth anymore.
Yeah, I don't care if it's deliberate or not, but it also doesn't square at all with the cleanliness in a way. I mean, yes, they go to like garbage town and there's a lot of fog and smog and whatnot, but there's something so crisp and clean about all the visuals that I think really, for me, moves away what I thought worked so well about this particular movie world, and it doesn't account for the 30 years that have passed in between the two in a meaningful way. And I just think that all the straight lines and the solid colors, and I just thought it was really sort of visually inert, as inert visually as it is dramatically. And we haven't even mentioned Jared Leto, whose entire role, even if it were played by David Bowie, as Denis Villeneuve may have originally hoped, is a disaster.
I mean, I think that Leto is pretty superfluous in this movie. I don't really understand what they intended to have him add to, because it sounds like he wrote all his own dialogue too, that he was just like rambling on and the cameras were rolling. I have no idea what was going on there. He adds nothing. But I disagree with everything that you're saying, David. I think you're totally wrong about the dramatic momentum, not just because there's a detective story going on and I'm curious about what these clues he's finding, where he's being led next, what this world, opening this world up from the original Blade Runner. I find this to be more of a movie, you know, with a character arc than the original Blade Runner, which was a rumination of sorts, but mostly an experiment in production design and mood and speculative
Loved
fiction.
It.
which is fine. I mean, I really like the original movie too, but like this is able to, you know, paint these scenes of futuristic technology and life, everyday life, the mundanity of what the future could be and how technology has brought us there, and show the practical elements, be very tactile, but then also have a real propulsive mystery. Last week we were talking about Gosling not being a good actor, and I really am not a fan of his, and I was impressed here. I just think he is chewing on something complex about being between this human state, but we also get to see something beyond him. You know, his girlfriend Joy is a hologram. I like that idea, and I like how she plays against him, and how he interacts with her, and how he clings to her, and how he never has to tell us she's a hologram, or he never has to worry about feeling self-conscious about that, even though he's being judged. He's in an in-between state, and I find his performance to really reflect that and be true.
Would you agree that the entire thing about like downloading her consciousness into one physical stick is clumsy at best? And sort of cringe-inducing at worst.
Well, no, because of this backstory with the blackout, you know, the failure of technology actually sent us backwards to the point where we would have these kind of, you know, it's not all in the cloud. We lost the cloud. The cloud fucked us. And I think that's an interesting curveball to where the society is at. And
I don't think that
where
stuff
these living
is...
robots are.
I don't think that stuff is present enough in a meaningful way for it to have any weight. I just thought it was dramatically clumsy to the extreme. I also want to say something very obnoxious, which might serve listeners in the future, which is that in the span of 22 minutes, it is remarkable how many of these same themes the second episode of World of Tomorrow tackles and dominates and does in such
just
a more
stop.
Satisfying way.
But like,
who,
I
who
still,
cares?
When that film is available, please return to that idea. Thank you.
I just don't think that the themes that this movie tackles are like. I mean, obviously, it's a movie about themes and mood, like the original Blade Runner. But like, it's not saying anything new about humanity versus robots and artificial intelligence. But it's the way that it says it. It's the way that it anchors it in this character, Ryan Gosling. You think it's saying something new?
It's saying
about
something
that?
New because Ryan Gosling's K is not a special person. He is actually more human because he does not have a true purpose, and that things cannot be unlocked for him. You know,
although we don't know that until the very end.
Right. Well, it's a movie, so you actually build off everything that's happening in the movie, and by the end, it's telling you its point. Okay, so it's
But I think it's worth saying. But like, we are told that this is a movie about a special person. Like, he believes that he is hunting down his own backstory, and we do too. And
we
want to
believe
him,
that as people. We want to believe that we're on a path and that we're special. But in the end, we might be serving other people. We might be serving a larger purpose. And that's what his purpose is, to not be special. And I thought that was really profound, and to be truly human, to figure out what you are in this weird, like, this cosmos where man has created new man, that his true purpose is to both be independent and serve a larger, you know, a larger cause. I thought that was really fascinating.
Katie,
yeah, it's a really lovely note.
But Katie, you tweeted that you really appreciated some of the female characters, or at least the actresses who played them earlier today. Do you want to talk on that?
Yeah, well, you fought back at me, which is why we've come here to fight in this war room. I mean, I think I said that they were all fascinating women, which may be an overstatement. Like, I think we have, you know, you have a variety of development for a lot of these characters. And this is very much Ryan Gosling's movie. Like, I'm not going to give it saying it's like really giving the women an equal shot. But I think there's a lot of really interesting actresses here who I've never seen in anything else. Like, I looked up all of them afterwards, except for Mackenzie Davis and Robin Wright, obviously, I've seen them before. And there's a dynamism to there and to them. I mean, I think the woman who played the Terminator replicant is who's the assistant to Jared Leto. She's pretty incredible and powerful in this.
Yes, her name is Sylvia Hooks, and she's amazing. I thought she was terrific.
She's amazing. Mackenzie Davis has this very small part as a prostitute, but she's kind of got this soul to her. She has this really incredible sex scene where she shows up and she's kind of the hologram girlfriend is inhabiting her body. And that is it's so fascinating. So, David, as someone who liked her, and I thought about how, basically the plot of her is a subplot in this insanely overlong movie. I just thought it was such a nice, companion piece to that kind of story. What was it that didn't work about that for you?
I liked that scene in her. I don't know why I need to watch it again, point for point.
It's a different scene in her.
I also thought, it's essentially the same purpose, except for the character in her is not, the male character in her is not a robot, but... I also thought it was very wonkily done here. It just was not intrigued visually by how they did it, but the whole idea of the real person and the hologram sort of merging in that way, I think it sort of detracts from the emotional experience of what's happening there. Also, Mackenzie Davis is the strongest actress in this entire film, or actor of any kind in this entire film, and why are you doing everything you can to superimpose over her? As much as I thought that Ana de Armas does everything that one would need her to do in this movie, and I can say nothing bad about her performance, but I don't know. I just found all this is not a movie where I think any character of any gender or genetic makeup is particularly well served, but yeah, it's a world that has been subsumed by male fantasy. I think, with the remnants of it are all sort of driven by male culture, male wants, and Robin Wright's character is a big outlier in that regard, and maybe the only character in the film that we can say is 100% absolutely human, besides Edward James.
And that dude who gets killed, who was in The Dark Knight, the creepy guy.
Oh, yeah,
he's definitely human. Yeah. He bleeds out.
Do replicants not bleed out? Do we know that?
I know. No, replicants true. They do.
No, replicants bleed out.
They totally do, because Jared Leto kills one of them. Dave, I feel like we haven't heard enough from you, and I'm curious what you thought of Jared Leto, because I did kind of expect him to ruin the movie for me, and I didn't like him, but I don't know. It wasn't a deal breaker.
He's the best in the short that takes place before the movie that was released on YouTube shows the moment that... Well, it shows the moment that Benedict Wong gives him the power to make more replicants, and it's nice because it's Jared Leto doing a short scene and you understand who the character is. By the time we got to him doing his thing, I was so distracted by how that place was being shot that I was able to just zone out of the things I didn't like of Jared Leto and watch the reflections of the light on the wall and wonder where the point lights were. But it's my overall... gripes with this movie, I feel ultimately boil down to expectations. Where nobody was allowed to spoil anything about this movie. People started saying it was maybe a masterpiece. I was maybe I'm not going to do the thing where I, read about what the movie's going to be. Maybe I'll just let it, meet me where I'm trying to meet the movie. The problem was that I was expecting something about how we use people we've already agreed have some sort of consciousness in the first Blade Runner as slaves. And instead, they decided it was more interesting to talk sort of about the consciousness concept through a Christ narrative than it was to deal with any of these, I think, modern issues that it could have been dealt with in a Blade Runner sequel. So it's just weird to see it take a lateral step, I feel, thematically, instead of trying to further things.
But how does it not with the pregnancy? How are you reckoning with this whole pregnancy line and how Jared Leto wants to farm these people and to be the true God? He needs to own this woman's ability to give birth. I mean, I don't really understand calling this a male fantasy, David, but it definitely has to do with men, and it has to do with them lording over people and owning them and being able to recreate a woman and shoot her in the head. Which is despicable, and then men fearing their role alongside women. I think Deckard running away from his child. There's a lot of complicated male issues.
Explicitly sexual, but I mean, we've been talking a lot recently, and for good reason, about the male lust for power and how all-consuming and demeaning that can be, and it just definitely seems like a world that, for worse or for worser, has been submitted and sort of corrupted by that power. You don't see.
Well, is it just supposed
that's
to?
That's a theme, not a.
Is it just supposed to ask you to ask a question, or is it just or is it presenting a side?
That's
because
not
if
a,
Deckard's.
Yeah, like, that's not a criticism unto itself. It's totally valid to present a sci-fi dystopian world where that is the case. I just don't think that the movie did anything particularly interesting with that. And it just so happens that maybe as a result of that, all of its female characters are one-dimensional to the point where, you know, one-dimensional, not by right, because one of them's a hologram who can.
But how is she one-dimensional when at the end, like this one, the Terminator replicant, as Katie keeps calling her, is she's on a mission to both follow orders, but she's clearly rogue at a certain point. She's going to accomplish this mission on her own terms. And when she feels like she's bested these adversaries, these men in her life, she proclaims like I am the best one. Like I find that really, that line gave me a chill. I thought that was really extreme and speaking to the point of
that. That's fair.
Dimensionality.
I can't speak to that right now after one viewing. I will say I was so phenomenally bored by the movie by that point, and I so hated how this, like, it all looks like it's a Christopher Nolan action scene. Like, all of the action in this movie, what little there is, reminds me of the ice sequence, the snow fortress sequence in Inception. It's all just these, like,
which is funny
flat,
there's nothing that
generic
big in this
spaces.
Movie.
No, there isn't. But even when they're fighting in the water tank outside of the car and in the car, oh, I mean, it's like, it's just such
Katie, stick up for that scene.
Flat,
you like that
uncomplicated
scene.
Uncomplicated action. Oh man, I couldn't agree less.
I mean, I'd like, so we were talking to Joanna Robinson about how she, in her screening, a lot of people walked out, and I would kind of got to a point in the movie where I was like, all right, I get how I can see if like you're not on board with this movie, Harrison Ford still hasn't shown up, it's going on forever, you would get sick of it. And I have been known to get fed up with movies that are overly long, but it really sold me, and it sold me on the stakes of it for its characters and the twist of it, its narrative. So that by the time things like that come along, like I'm super invested. But if you've been there for 2.5 hours and that comes along, I mean, I still think it's really well made action scene, but I can't tell you you're wrong for thinking this movie maybe was too long and too ponderous, because it certainly is.
So
even though
funny.
Patches, I
didn't
wonder
get bored at all, because there's a turn every like 40 minutes. I mean, there's like 3 sections to this movie, clear narrative breaks where a gear shifts into a new and I don't know, how do you get bored? Get an attention span.
I mean, I was so hyped for this movie. I really do love the original Blade Runner and the world that it creates, and I was bored from the moment this movie began.
I was also
and
sitting in the front row at my screening, so I was basically snorting this
well,
movie.
Well, let's talk about the. This is obviously dependent on where and the conditions into which you see it, but certainly watching this at the Dolby screening room in Manhattan, where I think Patches and I saw it at least, it was possibly the loudest movie I've ever seen. And I wonder if Patches and I can find common ground on this point. That Denis Villeneuve has a real problem with movie music, and that the music in this film, the drone, the fart-like wail that covers most everything, it's even worse than I can imagine. Like, I thought that firing Johan Johansson, who makes terrible movie music in my opinion, even though he makes beautiful music elsewhere, was going to be to this movie's advantage. But the Hans Zimmer, Benjamin Wallfish stuff they replaced it with is like 2-hour and 45-minute.
It's really just ambience
I mean, the Vangelis score for the original is so bright, it's so vibrant, it's so alive, it has this sort of shimmering texture to it, and this just felt as thick and oppressive as the smog is meant to this film. And maybe for some people that is what this movie needed and it works, but I was so desperate for something pretty in this film, something that wasn't just oppressive, that I really...
Well, what's funny is there's a few melodic bits in this, and I've heard that Hans Zimmer has been on the press trail saying that there was no temp music. He just stepped in and I made this score. It's so amazing. It's but I would highly recommend, after listening to this podcast, to hop on Spotify and listen to the cue for Joy, the hologram girlfriend, and then immediately go and listen to the cue from Ex Machina called Skin by Ben Salisbury and Jeff Barrow. It's stolen. It's exactly the same thing.
Two Ex Machina shoutouts.
Yeah.
It's
the whole score is derivative. That's a disappointment for me, because I think the visuals do add a lot and are very innovative and are just stunning to watch in the front row of a movie theater. I don't know how you
I don't know how he could sit there and be bored by that. There's such detail and the luminescence of the and the shadows. I don't know. I went gaga for it. I'm not necessarily Roger Deakins' like biggest proponent. It's not like I sit there at Sicario and I'm like, oh good God, the silhouettes. Oh, but
no, but you did stay awake during Tron Legacy, so yeah,
I would love to see this movie on Fast Forward, but I do think that there is probably too much going on to write off completely in one viewing, most of which I spent desperately wishing the movie were over, so maybe we can revisit it down the line.
Yeah, I still say
read Nabokov's Pale Fire, and I think it really helps understand the movie. That's his baseline test, or lines from that poem, so it's definitely supposed to be there. And if you check it out, it's really cool. I don't want to get all English lit on you, but there's a misprint that leads to two people discovering themselves in the poem that will have you questioning some stuff in Blade Runner 2049. I found that subtext, and I still don't think it's that interesting, but maybe.
That does it for this week's Fighting in the War Room. We'll be back next week. It'll be an all Porg episode, so please look forward to that.
Yes.
In the meantime, tell the people who you are.
I am Matt Porgiches, and I'm the executive entertainment editor of Thrillist.com, and I'm on Twitter at Mr. Patches. We have a website, fightinginthewarroom.com, where you can listen to the episodes, you can share them, and you can leave your thoughts, and we'll check them out, and maybe even read them on the show. And remember, whoever's about to tell you about our Facebook page, we're going to have a contest this week to win a Blu-ray copy of Girls Trip. And you have to do a thing on Facebook that I said at the beginning of the episode. And if you forget, you have to go to the beginning.
I'm David Ehrlich. I'm the senior film critic for IndieWire. You can find me on Twitter at David Ehrlich. You can find all of us together on Facebook at Fighting in the War Room. That's Fighting in the War Room.
I'm Dave Porgzalis. That'll work. Dave Porgzalis. Angry on the internet at DA7E. Breaking down Blade Runner again for this week's Storm of Spoilers, which you can find at stormofspoilers.com.
And I'm Porgy Rich. You can find me at vanityporg.com. I'm just going to keep this going. And on Twitter at Katie Rich, KateyRich. And we're all on Twitter at FITWR, where we'd love to hear your reactions to The Last Jedi trailer. Or you can also answer this week's lightning round question, which was,
in honor of the Foreigner, and besides the scene in The Legend of the Drunken Master, what's your favorite Jackie Chan moment?
Oh god, I yawned again in the middle of the outro.
Blade Runner 2049?
That does it for this. Oh god. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week. Only facts, I will shoot up. Baby duck if it quacks with a Ruger. Top billing, come cops and villainous shots. This block shipped out and bought, and y'all feeling it. LP killing it. Killer Mike killing shit. What more can I say? We top billing it. Valiant without villainy. Viciously found victory. Burnt towns and villages. Burning, looting, and pillaging. Murderers try to hurt us. We curse them and all the